Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
One of the things that James and Gracie Boggs are often quoted with saying is that we are the leaders that we've been waiting for. And folks like Freedom Freedom and D-Town and Oakland Avenue, I draw a lot of inspiration from because they've made a way out of no way.
We're devoting most of today's show to an interview with Shane Bernardo, who does community organizing in Detroit around issues of food justice. Our conversation touches on urban farming, intergenerational trauma, and the power of food to connect us with traditions of those who've come before us. We also have a couple of news stories, and yes, there's a recipe. So stay tuned. Hi, Alex. You got some news for us?
Hi, Kate. I've got two stories about Hurricane Florence.
I wondered if there might be some food news there.
Yeah. One story's about hog farms. The other's about a chef who seems to follow natural disasters.
All right. Take it away.
Despite early optimism from North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Hurricane Florence has already triggered one of the worst pig manure spills in the state's history. On Wednesday, North Carolina's Environmental Agency reported that 21 pig manure lagoons had risen over their banks, and another 36 were on the edge of overflow. Hog industry officials have downplayed the damage from Florence and say the worst has already passed. But on Thursday, rivers were still rising. The manure from industrial farms is held in large reservoirs where it's treated with bacteria and turned into fertilizer that's sprayed on crops. Heavy rains have caused those lagoons to spill over several times in the last few decades. That waste can carry dangerous diseases into waterways, including Salmonella, Giardia, and E. coli, as well as pharmaceuticals. In the wake of Hurricane Florence, many people do not have access to cooking equipment. So the USDA has changed its rules for food stamp recipients in North Carolina to allow them to use their benefits cards for hot and prepared meals. But retailers may take up to 36 hours to accept the change, and some are only taking cash. So Chef Jose Andres has stepped in to fill the gap. This week, he headed to North Carolina with his nonprofit, the World Central Kitchen, and a backup generator. They're making Salisbury steak with mushrooms, roasted garlic mashed potatoes, and fresh squash salad for evacuees in Raleigh and Wilmington. Chef Andres is getting some experience with disaster relief. After Hurricane Maria swept through Puerto Rico, he organized 20,000 volunteers to serve over 3 million meals. And he's been critical of the government's response in the past. After Hurricane Maria, he tweeted that his organization was feeding the National Guard in Puerto Rico, and that the Federal Emergency Management Agency was leaving the people there hungry and thirsty. As of Monday, Andres' World Central Kitchen has been the only major food relief organization in Raleigh and Wilmington. And that's the news. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow for those stories.
Thanks for bringing us the news, Alex. Find more food news on our Twitter feed, at Earth Eats.
My name's Shane Bernardo. I'm a long life Detroiter, and my pronouns are he, him, his. I've really gotten away from using the term activist to describe myself. I like to say that I'm a person that does community organizing.
I sat down with Shane Bernardo at a Detroit diner called The Click during the Allied Media Conference in June. I first got to know Shane through his work with Why Hunger, He's a skilled facilitator and an insightful guide through difficult conversations around hunger and food justice. Shane is also a grower. He worked with Earthworks Urban Farm in Detroit for many years. I asked about his current practice of growing food.
I grow food for a friend of mine that has a pop-up restaurant that she has every week. It's called Gorilla Food Cart. It's hosted in Corktown by the old Detroit Tiger Stadium location. And one of her main deals with her food is medicine, and how food has the power to heal us and bring us together. So that really resonated with me. So I met with her early in the year then to figure out what kind of ingredients she wanted to feature in her food. And from that point, I've been growing food for her pop-up dinner that happens every week.
I know you've been growing food in other contexts, not just this one. So what does it mean to you to be growing your own food or growing food for other people?
I helped run a small urban farm here on the east side of Detroit for 7 years. And that's a much different context than how I see my connection to food and growing food in my own backyard. The garden that I'm tending to in my own backyard gives me a chance to connect with my food in a much more personal way. The power of food and our ability to use it as a medium to create connections between ourselves and the earth, ourselves and our traditions that help maintain that connection, and ourselves and our ancestors. For many indigenous peoples around the world, we see the earth as our first mother. So my garden is a chance for me to commune with my people and my ancestors. The earth and the water existed long before any of us were here. So the earth and water is our living ancestors, our living ancestors. And so my garden is a place for me to practice a sense of sacredness and reverence with the soil, and I'm cultivating that connection through gardening and growing food. So I see my garden as sort of an altar to bring in a sense of spirituality to the work that I'm doing around food, and use it as a way to ground myself in the work that I'm doing around food and food justice work.
I'm glad that you said food justice, because it was something I wanted to ask you. It's a term that, you know, gets thrown around a lot and means different things to different people, and I would love to hear you say what it means to you.
Food justice and social justice work more broadly is deeply spiritual work. For people that are indigenous to this landmass, they may say that social justice movements started in 1492, and so possibly in that same vein, for me and my ancestors, our social justice and food justice work began in 1521, when Western contact first started in the Philippines, that eventually displaced and colonized my ancestors in the Philippines. When my people, my family, my ancestors were displaced from our ancestral lands, it also displaced our ability to practice our spiritual traditions and maintain this connection with the earth, which gave birth to our spiritual traditions and customs and rituals. And so my attempt at practicing food justice is a way of, again, bringing in a sense of spirituality, a sense of sacredness, a sense of reverence in reclaiming my connection, my birthright to the earth, to my ancestor, to my people and our traditions. Food justice is just a term that I use sometimes for its convenience, but it goes much deeper than that for me.
Another topic that I was interested in, so it, especially in Detroit, but in other places too, there is a you know, kind of urban farming movement. There's a lot of gardens sprouting up in cities, and it's always really seen in this positive light of this is nothing but a good thing. And I have been interested in some of the unintended consequences of urban gardening and urban farming, especially depending on who's doing it and how they're doing it.
There isn't one aspect of colonialism and Western imperialism that hasn't touched our lives and impacted us in some form or fashion. And urban farming is not any different. And so in the attempts to respond to your question, not all urban farming here in Detroit is the same. There's some folks that have used urban farming as a way as continued displacement or to appropriate other people's culture. A lot of times urban farming gets presented as this new thing. The image and face that you see associated with urban farming is a young, hip, white person that's recently moved to Detroit, because Detroit often gets presented as this blank slate where you can write your name across the sky and subsist upon the land with very little means, which is a very attractive narrative to young, possibly college-educated, artistic-type folks that want a place to create. Not that creating things is necessarily a bad thing, but oftentimes this narrative and young people that attach themselves to this narrative about the city of Detroit perpetuates the violence, the generational violence that has been imposed upon communities of color, refugee communities, native communities, immigrant communities, and communities of color and low-income communities as a way of taking up space and taking up resources. So oftentimes when you see gardens and farms in the media associated with these young white faces, oftentimes it's the people of color in the background that are doing the work. Like, I see this a lot in like youth programming. Like, a lot of times it'll be young white women that have college degrees, may have finished university recently, and come to the city of Detroit because they want to do something good with their lives, which also is not a bad thing, but you know, you also have to look at things within this historical and political context as well. And so Detroit often gets presented as this wasteland, as this post-industrial wasteland where nothing exists, and a lot of young folks in the media are taking advantage of this wasteland narrative to present urban farming as this new thing. But if we understand the history of Native peoples on this land, in particular the Anishinaabe peoples, the Confederacy, the Three Fires, the Odawa, the Ojibwe, and the Potawatomi, they have been hunting, foraging, fishing, and growing food in this area long, long before any of us were here. So in relative terms, what's new isn't growing food. What's new is the city of Detroit. These arbitrary boundaries that we use to describe where we're standing and where we're sitting. So I really like to put urban farming in this historical, more accurate and historical and political framework, because it helps us understand the impacts of urban farming and the narratives that come with it in the dominant media without us even realizing it.
What are some of the models that are happening in Detroit right now that you are excited about?
An organization called Detroit Summer. Detroit Summer is an intergenerational movement here in Detroit. Detroit Summer and people from the Boggs Center like James and Gracie Boggs, but also elders in our community like Gerald Hairston and other folks that were part of the Gardening Angels, who are elders from the South that moved up here with their parents when they were young during the Great Migration. And people that were escaping the oppressive measures that were being practiced in the South after Reconstruction that made it very oppressive for African descended folks that were kidnapped from their ancestral lands. And so these are folks that brought with them extensive knowledge around food and farming and growing food, that worked with young people in our community to take back ownership of our neighborhoods through community gardens. One of the things that James and Gracie Boggs are often quoted with saying is that we are the leaders that we've been waiting for. And folks like Feedom Freedom and D-Town and Oakland Avenue, I draw a lot of inspiration from, because they've made a way out of no way. They've used their social capital in a way that not only just like takes us away from seeing farming and growing food in this very like capitalistic way of extracting wealth from the earth, but it also gives us an opportunity and a platform to see ourselves as champions of our own narratives and champions of our own stories and not wait for people to save us. So I draw a lot of inspiration from those farms in particular, and they give me a lot of hope. Yeah.
This is Earth Eats. We'll be back with the rest of our interview with Shane Bernardo in just a moment. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Kate Young. Let's return to my conversation with Shane Bernardo.
I read a piece that you wrote for Why Hunger about intergenerational trauma and food, and I was wondering if you would be willing to talk a little bit more about that.
A lot of the contemporary issues that we're dealing with today have been inherited. For instance, back home in the Philippines, that trauma of being displaced and not being able to practice our spiritual traditions, our earth-based traditions, our subsistence traditions, has a compounding effect over multiple generations. And that compounding effect gets passed on through the years to your progeny. I recently went back home to the Philippines to visit my family in Nueva Vizcaya. And what I found was that in my attempt to heal from the grief of losing my father in 2010 to chronic disease and losing my grandmother in 2016, in my attempt to heal from that grief, what I found was when I went back home to reconnect with my family, I also found that I was carrying the grief of my ancestors. Of being displaced in the diaspora and forced to make a living on the land that I'm not native to. And so one of the ways that I use to cope with that is through food, is by eating foods that are familiar to me, that I grew up eating, that were passed down through the generations, and that give me a sense of identity and familiarity with my people and my ancestors who I long to have a relationship with. Some of the foods that I'm growing in my backyard are culturally relevant foods that are synonymous with my people's traditions around celebrating, growing, and sharing food with other people. It's not just a practice of consumption, but it's also a practice of nourishing my spirit and using it as a medium to connect with other people. So some of the examples of the foods that I'm growing are like garlic and onions, but the ones that I'm like most proud of are some of the nightshade varieties. I'm growing like 3 or 4 different types of tomatoes, growing eggplants, growing different types of chilies. Even though like Philippine cuisine and food is really not known for it being spicy, I have a hard time tasting my food unless I'm in pain, because I really like that spice, that kick. And I'm also growing ground cherries, and yeah, so I really like the nightshade family because these are foods that I grew up eating. I'm first generation in Detroit, and my family kept a garden ever since I was a kid, before it was even called urban gardening or urban farming. So I use these foods, again, to maintain this connection to my people, my ancestors, and our cultural traditions.
Is there a particular dish that you can think of that you like to cook that really connects you to your family's traditions and your culture?
Yeah, there's one particular dish. It's actually a really simple dish. It's kind of like a porridge, almost. It's kind of it's like a rice congee. We call it lugao. It's a very like humble meal, a lot of times it would just be like a piece of chicken on the bone and the leftover rice from the previous dinner or meal, and some fresh ginger and some scallions, and some fried garlic on top. But it's so nourishing. And one of the reasons why I particularly like that meal is because my grandmother used to make it for me when I was younger, when I was sick. And just to feel that in my belly recalls this connection that I have with my grandmother and her nourishing spirit, and how she used to take care of us when my parents would go to work. So I grew up in a multi-generational household, and food was one of the ways that my grandmother expressed her love and care for her family. And so sometimes when I'm missing her spirit, I just want to ground myself in that place of familiarity. Sometimes I turn to food as a way of doing that. And lugao is just one of the few dishes that really help build that connection.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You can find out more about Shane Bernardo on our website. We'll have links to his work and to some of the organizations he mentioned in Detroit, like the Boggs Center, Feed 'em Freedom, and D-Town Farm. That's at eartheats.org. Today's recipe comes from Chef Daniel Orr. It's a classic French salad. It's substantial, and it's the very definition of simplicity.
Today we're going to do one of my favorite summer salads. This is a salad I learned in France when I was working in France, and they love their lentils. The lentil that they admire most is called a lentille de Puy, which means a lentil from the Puy, P-U-Y, region of France, and that is a volcanic region that has very rich, intense soil. And they are small, kind of dark brown to black, little lens-shaped beans, which lentil means lens-shaped, like your lens in your eye. And they are deeply flavored, and they cook very quickly. And that's one of the things about lentils, all lentils, cook quicker than other beans. So, you know, white beans and red beans and black beans, they're much larger. A lot of times you want to soak them ahead of time before you cook them. Lentils will cook in 15 to 30 minutes. So it's a very easy bean to do when you're on a tight time budget. What I've done is I've put a cup of lentils in about 3 cups of water, and I always save my orange peels to use to season my food with. So, I mean, why throw things away when they give great flavor? The orange peel has a wonderful content of orange oil, and so it has a different flavor than the orange, like the sweet citrus inside. It's more of a perfume. So I use that orange in all kinds of things, whether I'm cooking rice or beans, or making marinades. I can also grind it and use it in marinades and spice blends and kinds of stuff like that. So then I also have some fresh bay leaves, and they add a certain je ne sais quoi to the dish. So now that we've cooked those, and it takes about, like I said, 15 minutes to half an hour maximum, we just want to taste them and make sure they're cooked all the way. Okay, and they're tender, but they're not mushy. And that's one of the great things about the French lentil, the lentille de Puy, is that they kind of keep their structure. And the classic way to serve these is to grab a dish. You're going to remove the bay leaf and the orange peel. Although the orange peel is edible, the bay leaf is not. The classic dressing for this is walnut oil dressing. So I've got some roasted walnut oil, which it's got a really great aroma to it. Don't need a whole lot. Lemon juice. Again, it's about a half a lemon to that cup of lentils. And then finally, some walnuts. And then we're going to add whatever herbs you like. You could add chives, cilantro, mint to your dish. I've got some fennel fronds, and I've got some mint. I'm just going to chop those up. I like to leave my herbs in kind of big pieces because I like to have a kind of a voyage in the mouth where you're tasting different things at different times. If you chop everything super fine, it's just all going to taste the same throughout the eating of the dish. Whereas if you have kind of chunky herbs, every bite is going to be a little different flavor. You can smell this. I'm just going to add a little salt and pepper. And this is a classic summer salad in France. Also served warm a lot of times with saucisson, which is a warm sausage.
Time for a taste.
It's almost meaty.
Yeah, it really is.
You know,
that is so
nice.
You don't
need anything else. This and some greens.
The roasted walnut oil.
Right? Isn't that amazing?
Try it for yourself. Get the recipe at eartheats.org. Special thanks this week to Shane Bernardo and Chef Daniel Orr. Thanks also to Aabon Binder, photographer and webmaster. To our associate producer and news anchor, Alex Chambers. Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow put the news reports together. Mark Chilla is the production director. We work with Indiana University's Food Institute, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, and Harvest Public Media. Our theme music was composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. We do appreciate you listening and hope that you'll subscribe to our podcast. That way, you never miss an episode. For Earth Eats, I'm Kate Young. See you next time.